I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Why are members of the Afghan police and military killing coalition forces in Afghanistan? Yesterday, two American soldiers were killed by an Afghan soldier in the eastern part of the country. So far this year, 42 coalition forces have been the victims of insider killing, 12 in this month alone. One of the goals of the U.S. NATO mission is to train enough military and police in Afghanistan so the country will be more stable as foreign troops begin to withdraw. These violent incidents raise troubling questions about U.S. policy and strategy in Afghanistan, our topic for today's Radio Times. We begin our conversation with Graham Boley. He's a correspondent for the New York Times based in Kabul, Afghanistan. And Graham Boley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What can you tell us, or what have you learned in the last 24 hours about this attack on Monday where two American soldiers were killed?
It was in the east of the country. They're happening all over the country, depending on where the troops are. This month has seen this great spike in the insider attacks, as the military calls it, and that there are a few big incidents in Helmand in the south where Marines were killed by seemingly Afghan soldiers. Yesterday's was in the east, so that was sort of a new issue. And it's in an area where Americans are mainly pulled out. They're still there, but they're pulled out in a very rugged area. And what seems to have happened was it was outside the base. An American patrol was caught by an IED, a roadside bomb. Nobody was hurt, some vehicles were damaged, and they'd stopped when an Afghan patrol came along. They were separate, and sort of early in the morning, and some sort of disagreement erupted, and an Afghan opened fire and killed two American soldiers, and the Afghan was killed in return. That's as much we know, and that's as much we know in most of these incidents, But the American military here, the coalition, has sort of seen the great frequency with which it is happening and is trying to catch up and work out more. So it's going back and looking at each of these incidents now and trying to work out the kind of interest, the kind of essential, necessary understanding about why this is happening. And they're starting to trying to get to grips with it.
Well, and I heard General John Allen talking about this, wondering whether the combination of Ramadan and the hot weather, perhaps even the pressure of the battlefield, might explain these so-called insider attacks. From what you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, the big, the Taliban, which is fighting the insurgency here, say it's their guys. They're infiltrating. And there are some people think that this is a new and quite successful method that they're using. They're using a number of new methods in the current fighting season. You know, it's summer here and it's the fighting season. They've been forced on the back foot by the success of the military to fight a different sort of war. They're not fighting face-to-face. They're fighting with roadside bombs detonated from a distance. Now they seem to be fighting by infiltration. And the U.S. military, in its investigation, now seems to think some of this can be explained by infiltration. So, Taliban Afghans posing as soldiers, getting through the process, going into the army. And you have to understand, at the moment, there's a huge build-up. Like, there's a great rush to build up the Afghan army and police so that the coalition can leave, so that the Afghan state can take care of itself. So, thousands, 3,000, more than that each month are going into the army, and some Taliban are getting in, and once they're in, they're shooting their American and other British and other coalition counterparts.
Reading some of your reporting, you obviously talking with U.S. or NATO military, very concerned about this development. Also that the creation of something called Guardian Angels, can you describe that for us?
Yeah, well, as the military has realized it's got to get to grips with this, I mean, it's been a problem around for a couple of years, but it's really taken off this year. They've tried to, come up with ways to tackle it, and it's really hard because the whole point at the moment of this, of the presence here is to work closely, cooperate, and train so the Afghans can be on their own. So you have to be in close proximity. So how do you do that? Now, suddenly, American soldiers are being told to carry weapons with, you know, full magazines in their gun. So if there is anybody starts, if anybody does start to shoot, they can react really quickly, and you know, this will save like a few seconds and a few lives. And another measure they're taking is the system called Guardian Angels, which is whenever coalition troops, American troops are with Afghans, you know, even in meetings, there'll be one person amongst the American soldiers who is designated, whose sole job is, even on sort of a patrol or in an attack, is to watch the Afghans for body language, for any sense of warning, and they have the authority to shoot that person dead. Mm. So suddenly you have this new policy inserted in the relationship, and you know it's a bold step. And the coalition, the commanders here know that there's a fine line here that they're treading between safety and damaging trust. But I think they've realized that they've got to be safety first here.
Well, and just picking up on what you said, you're describing then training people for the military, for the police, who you may not trust.
Right, people you don't know, people you don't understand. I mean, and that's the other big thing that the military has found. It has sort of, it's looked at about 100 cases. It found a very small, you know, 1 in 10, you know, proportion, they say, is the Taliban infiltration. The rest is explained in some other way, and that's what General Allen was talking about this week, was, or last week, was there are a number of cultural explanations. You know, Ramadan is happening, people are pushed together in these sort of very confined spaces, it's really hot, they're hungry. They're working with foreign soldiers, the Afghans are working with foreign soldiers who don't understand their culture. So, you know, he puts a lot of this down to kind of cultural misunderstandings, cultural clashes, also personal clashes, you know, people together. And, you know, other analysts say, you know, these people that are being brought into the military from the Afghan, and the police, particularly the police and the different areas of the police from the Afghan side, they've not worked in these environments before, they've not had jobs before, and they're suddenly given a gun. That's a huge responsibility, and they're using this in a way to settle arguments.
Are we seeing, though, in Afghanistan a resurgent Taliban, whether they're involved in these insider attacks or not? But there are reports, in fact, you reported on the fact that the Taliban allegedly killed 17 civilians in Helmand province, cut their throats, men and women. Are we seeing the return of the Taliban?
General Allen made the point when he spoke last week that the attacks may have gone up, but they're in places that matter less. They're in, you know, remote areas. So the kind of the destruction they wreak is less. He would say, you know, the coalition is winning. They're building this kind of strong army and police, this great to kind of hold the line. And they're also taking the fight to them. And, you know, the operations of weapons caches being discovered. On the other hand, the Taliban are still there, and it's hard, and as you're right, yesterday's attack shows they're still there, and they're in areas which are beyond control of the Afghan state or the, you know, the coalition military here. And some people wonder whether, you know, they're still there, they're just hiding, they're across the Pakistan border, and they're waiting now that we have this deadline of the withdrawal of 2014, they're waiting for America to leave. Why not? Why take the fight to the Americans? So when they can just wait. So we don't really know. Yesterday's attack was really horrible and bloody. 17 people were killed, their throats slit in this remote place. And it shows they're still there, and it shows that they control areas that, you know, that the coalition hasn't won back.
You reported today about the police chief in Kandahar province escaped an attack, but also this is a police chief that seems to be challenging the Taliban and their allies.
Yeah, General Rafiq is a really interesting and some would say controversial figure. You know, he used to be in control of the border regions down there with Pakistan. Said he, you know, he used smuggling to his advantage, even as he was fighting the Taliban and, you know, keeping the place secure. And officials saw him sort of as almost a necessary, you know, they were uncomfortable with him and some of his tactics and some of the business deals he did on the side. but they also welcomed, especially during the surge a couple of years ago, you know, the welcome, the he was very effective in bringing security to that area. Last year, the police chief of Kandahar was killed in a bombing, in a suicide bombing in the police headquarters, and he was promoted to become the police chief of Kandahar. And he's brought those aggressive tactics now to the whole of Kandahar, and he's been carrying out several operations in the last year to, to take on the Taliban, and he's having great success. You know, some people question his tactics. They're supposed to be quite brutal. And he's imprisoned and killed a lot of Taliban officials, say. But he's quite popular down there. And down in the south, you know, this is the former Taliban heartland. And he's hated by the Taliban, who are still there. And he today was another attempt on his life. Or late last night was another attempt on his life. The governor himself was attacked a few months ago. And in another sort of audacious bombing attempt by the suicide bombing attempt by Adam, and today the governor escaped then, and today the general, the police chief, escaped.
About a minute and a half before we have to say goodbye to you, Graham. Are there parts of Afghanistan that are more stable than the parts of the country we've been talking about?
Definitely, yeah, there are. There's the north, which has traditionally been more stable. There's the west. Herat and Bamiyan, although, and I was in Bamiyan about 6 weeks ago, and this is a beautiful province, right in the center of Afghanistan, and sort of ethnically uniform, it's Hazara, and has not seen, typically for the last 10 years, has not seen the violence, although, that other areas have, although worryingly, in the last month, even there, we saw an encroachment and attacks on local police, and two attacks on the New Zealand soldiers who represent NATO there. And New Zealand is now pulling its troops out slightly early from Bamiyan. And so even there, in the Paradise province, which is very beautiful, there's trouble, and it speaks to some sort of greater sophistication on part of the Taliban insurgency, not just in Bamiyan, but in sort of other areas of the north. And it's not just the Taliban. It's the sort of the cohesion of the country is, you know, under examination as NATO withdraws with its military, you know, help and its economic help. The pressure on this country, which has kept it together, withdraws. And, you know, there's this great hope, and a lot of people put in a lot of great work to keep this place together, and a lot of investment from America, a lot of money has gone here, and people's lives as well. The hope is that will stay cohesive. But it's not just the Taliban, it's sort of these fractious ethnic groups and local warlords, even in the north, and especially in the north, actually, who have made a lot of money out of this war and who have now their own militia. And that's sort of frightening. That's what I'm sort of seeing, this sort of frightening aspect there, this tendency to pull apart, even in those normally safe parts of the country.
Well, Graham, we have to say goodbye to you, and I thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And that's a Graham Bowley, correspondent for the New York Times, joining us from Kabul, Afghanistan.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital uses an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
4 years ago, Republicans nominated John McCain for president.
I have a privilege given few Americans, the privilege of accepting our party's nomination for president of the United States.
This week, Mitt Romney will accept the party's nomination in Tampa. I'm Mara Liasson. Join us for special coverage from NPR News.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
We've all heard the negative comments about single mothers from politicians, preachers, and the people next door. So in our Moms Conversation, we want to hear from a group of single moms who want to speak for themselves.
In the morning, you have to get up and go do that PhD program and take care of your child, and it just has to be done.
Single mothers speak out next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are assessing U.S. strategy and policy in Afghanistan in light of a troubling development in that country. More attacks by members of the Afghan and military police on coalition forces. In fact, yesterday, two American soldiers were killed by an Afghan National Army soldier. Graham Boley from the New York Times was describing that for us. And joining us now is John Nagle. He's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. He's the Minerva Research Professor at the U.S. Naval Academy, studies and writes about the influence of culture on warfare. He also wrote the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual. And John Nagle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's good to be back, although I had a supporting role in writing the Counterinsurgency Manual, working for a guy named Petraeus, of whom you may have heard.
I have heard of a guy named Petraeus. Thank you for that correction.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you make of these insider attacks? They're not new, but they are on the rise.
They are on the rise, and they're very worrying because they strike at the heart of our strategy in Afghanistan. We're not going to defeat the Taliban completely. We're working to reduce the level of Taliban attacks to a level that an increasingly strong and capable Afghan security force can finish the job on its own, can protect Afghanistan on its own with a framework of American advisors inside it. And the trust that you and Graham talked about between the Afghan forces and the American and NATO forces who are working with them now, are going to continue to advise them for, I expect, at least a decade into the future, is the absolute linchpin of our success. So if the enemy can drive a wedge between us and the Afghans, can eliminate the trust between those two forces, the whole strategy collapses. So this is very, very worrying.
Do you think it raises questions about vetting the recruits? Graham seemed to indicate there's something like 3,000 recruits a month. That's a lot of recruits to try to vet. But is that something that the U.S. and NATO forces should do?
It is. It is also something that the Afghans themselves are going to have to take the lead in. And some of that is happening, and we can get better at that. But Graham hypothesized that only about 10% of these 100 or so cases of what we call green on blue attacks have actually been done by Taliban infiltrators. The majority of them are a result of tensions between cultural misunderstandings between the American advisors and the Afghan soldiers. And so I think we've really got to dig down deep into what is causing that friction and find every way we can to reduce it.
Do you think this hot weather / Ramadan is a partial explanation for what's going on?
I think that's part of it. I also think we need to recognize that what we see of this war is not what the Afghan people see of the war. And interestingly, just in the last 24 hours or so, we've had news come out of the punishments that the American military has inflicted on a number of Marines who sadly desecrated some Taliban corpses, on American soldiers who were complicit in the burning of a large number, we learn now, of Korans, both of which were absolute insults to the Afghan people whose interests we are protecting and whose cooperation we need. And I think that we've got to do a better job of seeing this war through the eyes of the Afghan people, demonstrating greater cultural awareness and cultural empathy as we work together with them to try to build a better future for Afghanistan.
I'm looking at a piece from the Associated Press this morning. The U.S. military said six Army soldiers escaped criminal charges but received administrative punishments for their involvement in the Quran burning, which roiled relations with Afghans. Should they have been punished more severely, do you think?
I don't think so. It's always difficult getting inside the specifics of the military justice system. I've been involved in it myself, and I wouldn't second-guess anybody who was involved there. And certainly there was no intent in this case to insult the Afghan religion or Islamic peoples. This was a case of neglect and failure to comprehend, which is staggering, frankly, given how long we've been fighting this war, but is not criminal in intent. I am more concerned, frankly, about the relatively light sentences handed down to the Marines who desecrated the Taliban corpses. That was an act not of a mission but of commission, and showed intent to desecrate those bodies. And I'm very concerned about that one, and I'm afraid that the relatively light punishment those Marines received may not be well received inside Afghanistan.
One thing I was reading about the Quran and some of these religious texts, according to the U.S. military, they were being used to transmit messages back and forth between, I guess, prisoners inside a prison and those on the outside.
And certainly we had every right to remove those Qurans and to replace them with new Qurans and to keep a closer eye on the prisoners who were using those documents. But there was no need to burn them. We could have put them on an airplane. There's lots of empty airplanes heading back to the United States. We could have put it in the archives next to the Lost Ark. All would have been well. It was the burning of the Qurans, not the removing of them from the prison, that really infuriated the Afghan people. And there were riots, and important to note, Afghan soldiers who were killed defending American troops from rioting crowds of Afghan people. So the relationship between the Afghan security forces and the United States forces is overwhelmingly one of mutual respect and understanding, with a small number in a force, an Afghan force of 350,000, an American force that near 70,000, a small number of, unfortunately, sometimes deadly interactions. And every one of those is a tragedy, and we've got to work hard to reduce them and eliminate them if we can. But it's important to note that there are Afghan soldiers every day putting their lives on the line, working hand-in-hand, shoulder-to-shoulder with American troops.
But here we are almost 11 years into this war, and we're still trying to understand the culture.
It's astonishing and horrifying. And in fact, the professorship I hold at the U.S. Naval Academy is one of a series constructed at our military academies and our war colleges throughout the country at the behest of Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, who was similarly appalled by the limited progress we've made in understanding our allies and our enemies, and many of them come from the same countries, and some of them may be enemies today and allies tomorrow, and the lack of effort we've taken as a country. And I compare this, and sadly in a negative light, to the extraordinary effort we made after Sputnik to learn science and technology and rocketry and electronics, where we put on a real national effort. We have not done the same thing in the wake of the September 11th attacks that revealed a huge divide between the United States and the Islamic world, and I don't think we've done as good a job as we should have of understanding both sides of that gap.
But even focusing on Afghanistan, this notion of liberating a country can lead one to think that you know, we know better than the Afghans.
That's exactly right. And we've actually done a reasonable job of setting up a government that although troubled and corrupt, still generates a very high degree of public support from the Afghan people. The Afghans view their lives as getting better, as indeed they have. They've gone from essentially no telephones to well over 15 million telephones inside their country in the course of a decade, from no girls in school to literally millions of girls in school over a decade. So if you live in Afghanistan, your life is getting better despite the continuing outrages inflicted largely by the Taliban, but also the it's more than discomforts. It's the danger associated with having a war fought inside your own country. So Afghanistan is getting better from the perspective of the Afghan people, but we haven't done the job we should have of really seeing this war through their eyes.
And that's John Nagel. He's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, the Minerva Research Professor at the U.S. Naval Academy, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. His Army experiences in Iraq led him to help write, I should say, the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual. Wrote a very influential book back in 2005, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. And I should add that next year he's going to be the headmaster at the Haverford School, which is located just outside of Philadelphia. But we are talking about Afghanistan, reassessing U.S. strategy and policy there. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John, my understanding for a counterinsurgency operation is to move troops out of bases, get them living among the people. And the idea is you want to protect the civilian population. It also, though, does make troops more vulnerable. They're not hiding, I won't say hiding, but they're not protected by the walls of a base. With that kind of policy, should one expect more casualties?
Sadly, in some ways one should, and this is one of the paradoxes that we wrote about in the counterinsurgency manual. The more successful you are, the more risk you need to take, and that does put the troops at risk. So we've moved out of the big bases. We did this both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and we're living among the people to a much greater extent. We're cooperating very closely with the local security forces, and that does put the troops at risk. But we have to remember that it's also the Afghans who are put at risk. So when you and Graham were talking about the Kandahar police chief, I was reminded of the police chief I worked with very closely in Iraq, Brigadier General Ismail, who similarly survived a car bomb on his police station and then an improvised explosive device, a roadside bomb, directed at him personally that was actually placed in the driveway of his home. And he continued to work with us at enormous personal risk to try to defeat Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the insurgents in Iraq, and build a brighter future for the people of his country. So Americans are at risk, but so were the Iraqis, the Iraqi security forces we worked with, and so are the Afghan security forces, who take casualties at a much higher rate than we do.
And how different and how similar are Iraq and Afghanistan when talking about this counterinsurgency policy?
So Afghanistan was always going to be the harder case. General Petraeus did a review of Afghanistan after rebuilding the Iraqi security forces returning to the United States before we wrote the counterinsurgency manual, and he told then-Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld that Afghanistan is going to be the harder case. It's a country that's been at war for 30 years. The human capital has really been denuded by that 30 years of war. It's not a very educated population. It doesn't have the infrastructure. And so Afghanistan is a tougher fight. It's also a much more rural fight. Iraq was a very urban fight, and in an urban fight, the population is more concentrated. It's easier to separate them from the insurgents. One last point, as I worked to train American advisors both for Iraq and Afghanistan, the shorthand I gave them was, in Iraq, they knew how the Iraqi security forces knew how to read, they didn't know how to fight. Mm-hmm. In Afghanistan, the people know how to fight, but they don't know how to read, and unfortunately it's harder to teach somebody to read than it is to teach them to fight. So we're working with basic literacy of the Afghan security forces, trying to get them up to second and third grade level, which you've got to have to be able to fight this kind of very intelligence-intensive war.
Should we, though, rethink this goal of recruiting and training Afghan military police forces so that the U.S. can begin to withdraw by, well, they're starting to withdraw now to some degree, but to be out by 2014?
There really isn't an alternative, and one of the reasons why Afghanistan, although a fighting war, a shooting war where we're losing Americans, sadly, a couple of times a week, is that both of the presidential candidates pretty much agree on the strategy, that is, building up Afghan security forces, handing off responsibility to them, and then it's important to emphasize to the American people, I think, we're going to have a long tail. There's going to be Americans serving as advisors in this fight, I would expect, for at least the next decade. And we'll have NATO allies there with us. We'll be providing some logistical support, air support, intelligence support. But also I expect combat advisors embedded inside these Afghan units for a number of years to come. And that's why these green-on-blue attacks are so concerning.
You mentioned President Obama and Mitt Romney. It's interesting in this election season, the campaign so far, there's almost no talk about Afghanistan.
I was surprised. I wrote a piece called The Age of Unsatisfying Wars after Memorial Day, when President Obama rightly recognized Vietnam veterans. He rightly recognized Iraq war veterans and the progress we've made in drawing down there over the last year. But he really didn't talk very much about Afghanistan, and that's the war that he's responsible for and that he's going to be judged by military historians for. And I think that there are reasons for him not to talk about it. It's not a popular war with the American people. Governor Romney really doesn't have any other ideas on what to do. There's a consensus among the security professionals that this strategy of handing off to the Afghan forces is our only alternative, because what happens in Afghanistan matters for the long-term security of the United States. And so this is a cost I'm afraid we're going to continue to pay for a number of years, but the alternatives are all worse.
Let me quote you from that piece that you wrote. You said, unsatisfying wars are the stock and trade of counterinsurgency. Rarely, if ever, will they end with a surrender ceremony and look like a conventional victory. And yet this is the sort of war we have fought almost exclusively for over 50 years. So we better get used to this.
We had better learn how to do this more effectively. And I teach a course on the history of modern counterinsurgency at the Naval Academy. I teach, I'm actually teaching them from Mao today and from Gallula. The principles of counterinsurgency warfare go back deep in military history, but conventional military forces have a hard time adapting to this kind of war. It's not the kind of war they spend most of their resources preparing to fight. And thus, when they are confronted by these challenges, they have to learn and adapt and figure things out on the go. And that costs dollars and time and, most importantly, the blood of our sons and daughters. And so we've got to do better.
And I want to pick up on that. But we have been in this country for more than 10 years, as I mentioned earlier. Is it too late to sort of rethink strategy and even repair some of the relationships that we have with the Afghan people?
Yeah, General Petraeus says that every intervention has a half-life, and he's exactly right. And the real tragedy of Afghanistan is that we neglected this war. We took our eye off the ball. We focused instead on Iraq, a war we didn't need to fight. But once we got into Iraq, we absolutely needed to succeed there, or at least not fail epically. And the distraction of the war in Iraq took all of the decision makers' time and attention. It took all of the soldiers that we had and more. We put a heavy cost on our Army and Marine Corps in terms of surging forces into Iraq. And Afghanistan was a war that we should be in a much better position than we are today. And you can't understand why we're so far behind after this many years unless you take account of the fact that we intervened in another place in a war we didn't need to fight at huge cost, at huge expense.
And we're almost up at a break here, but does that mean it's too late to repair our policy?
I don't think so. We've got a very good man in Afghanistan named John Allen, a Marine general, the first Marine to ever lead a theater of war in American military history, to my knowledge. John Allen understands and empathizes with the Afghan people. He's working hard to do better. But I do think that we should be very concerned and perturbed that we haven't done a better job of preparing our troops for the cultural space between them and the Afghan people they're protecting and the Afghan troops they're working with.
We are talking about Afghanistan with John Nagel, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. He's currently a professor at the U.S. Naval Academy. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. What should the U.S. do? 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The WHYY Connections Festival rocks the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. Yola Tango. Frank Turner.
After all, it was rock and roll.
Maps and Atlases.
And the moon stood stock still.
The Lawsuits.
I can't wait to get down to Tennessee.
Baby and Achilles. And more. Saturday, September 8th. More at WHYY.org/Connections Festival.
On the next Fresh Air, as the Republican convention begins, Boston Globe reporters Michael Cranish and Scott Hillman return to talk about Mitt Romney and some of the latest developments in his campaign. Their book, The Real Romney, has just been published in paperback with a new afterword. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us from Tampa for the news and these stories here and now. How are Mormons feeling about the first in their faith to get this close to the presidency? Also, what makes a good convention speech? That's here and now, Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about Afghanistan. It's been a violent summer in Afghanistan this past weekend. Taliban insurgents reportedly beheaded 17 Afghan civilians in Helmand province. Monday, an Afghan National Army soldier killed two American soldiers, bringing the number of inside fatalities to 12 in the last few weeks. As of last week, 2,000 American soldiers and Marines have died since the start of that war in Afghanistan. And our guest is John Nagle. And we are talking about counterinsurgency, some of the challenges facing the U.S. and facing the Afghan people. He helped to write the U.S. Army Marine Corps counterinsurgency field manual, fought in the Iraq War, and is a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, also a professor at the U.S. Naval Academy. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. John, I imagine under more traditional warfare, you kill someone like Osama bin Laden, and that might be the end of that war. Osama bin Laden was killed a little bit more than a year ago, but the fighting continues. What does that tell us?
Well, we're fighting a very different kind of enemy than the one that probably most of us think about when we think about the First World War, the Second World War. We're fighting a network of people who share a common set of beliefs and who are dedicated to imposing their worldview on a group of people, one that we find antithetical. And so the story you talked about, the 17 Afghan people apparently beheaded at a wedding celebration, is an example of the worldview that we are fighting against, and the objective we're facing. It's interesting to me. You mentioned a number of the bad things that have happened, that series of murders, certainly the green-on-blue killings of American troops. But we haven't talked at all about the fact that a major insurgent leader in the region, one of the Haqqani brothers, one of the leaders of the Haqqani network, arguably the most dangerous insurgent group currently afflicting Afghanistan and Pakistan, was reportedly killed in a drone strike over the weekend as well. So we are continuing to target insurgent leadership. We are making progress on that. We've certainly done a fairly remarkable job in effectively dismantling the leadership of Al-Qaeda Central in the Afghan-Pakistan region. There is still more work to be done, but we are in important ways making progress, and I don't think that progress gets talked about as much as it ought to.
No, fair enough. Graham Bowley was talking about this kind of dispersed enemy that is being fought in Afghanistan, perhaps some remnants of the Taliban, some warlords, insurgents. I mean, should we think of them as a kind of a ragtag army, or do they operate under their own strategy?
No, what we're facing is in some ways more like a network of different criminal groups who cooperate together at some times when it's in their interest, who sometimes fight against each other, but who very importantly have some degree of sanctuary inside Pakistan. And it's wrong to talk about Afghanistan without focusing also on Pakistan, a deeply troubled country with its own nuclear stockpile, a known proliferator of nuclear weapons technology to pariah states, and Pakistan, a country afflicted by a large number of insurgent groups itself, including the Haqqani network, and has proven either unwilling or unable to effectively cut off the support they receive, particularly in its northwest tribal regions. Pakistan, a country worth watching, in my eyes, in the opinion of Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the most dangerous country in the world for the United States. And our continued involvement in Afghanistan is in large part because of the threat that Pakistan presents to world order and security.
So looking ahead, I don't even want to use the words, you know, victory or winning or losing, but as you look ahead, what do you see for Afghanistan?
So I see a long-term American commitment of advisors. We currently have 70,000 troops in Afghanistan. We'll draw down to perhaps 20,000 by the end of 2014. And those American advisors will continue to help the Afghan security forces fight against an enduring Taliban insurgency, particularly in the south and the east of the country. Pakistan itself will also continue to be afflicted by insurgent groups, which attack not just into Afghanistan, but also attack Pakistani military bases, including, very worryingly, some that store nuclear weapons. And so we're going to continue to see a low-grade insurgency continue in Afghanistan and inside Pakistan. And Americans are, I'm afraid, going to continue to be lost in that struggle, helping their Afghan allies, although both the number of those lost and the frequency of Americans falling should go down, although we're going to see Afghan soldiers increasingly come to the front, and it's the Afghans and the Pakistani soldiers who are going to increasingly bear more of the burden of this continuing fight.
And what do you say to people who say, let's get the hell out of there?
I would tell them that we made that mistake before. So during the Soviet invasion of and fight inside Afghanistan, we, the United States, of course, supported the Mujahideen, those fighting against the Soviet occupation. We supplied them with arms and with money, largely through Pakistan, on routes that the insurgents are now using against the current Afghan government of President Karzai. And when the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan, and ultimately a huge victory in the Cold War, leading to, in many ways, contributing to the ultimate demise of the Soviet Union, a fact that has brought great rewards for international peace and security. But we took our eyes off of Afghanistan. We neglected it. And I'd recommend the movie Charlie Wilson's War.
Oh, sure.
Charlie Wilson, a Naval Academy graduate and a congressman back when being a congressman was really a wild ride. Charlie Wilson fought hard to get the United States to continue to support Afghanistan to try to prevent the Taliban from coming to power unsuccessfully. And when we failed to do that, when we failed to do what St. Augustine told us, which is the only purpose of a war is to build a better peace, we failed to build a better peace in Afghanistan, and we paid a very heavy price for that on September 11th. We can't allow terrorism to again find a home base in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're fighting hard to prevent that from happening, and I believe, although the cost is very high of the actions we're currently taking, the cost of inaction, of rapid withdrawal, might be far, far higher, and it might hit us a lot closer to home.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We have Al-Sayed from Norristown joining us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I think... with due respect, I think the military looks at things very differently from Afghanistan, especially in the Muslim world. I mean, when there's killings, they send the wrong people to the wrong people to talk to. In Islam, the mother is three times more important than the father. So when there's killings, the military needs to recruit respectable women to go to these mothers and ask forgiveness, because unless you this mother forgives you, the children will revenge. Like they say, only 10% of the killings are by Taliban with the military. That's because 90% of those people are probably from families whose children have been killed. So they have vowed to get revenge on behalf of their mom.
Well, I'll say, thank you for calling into Radio Times. And John Nagel, what he seems to be saying is that the military should think about using women more effectively to defuse some of these situations.
I absolutely agree. This has been a real failure of imagination on our part, I'm afraid. We've been so overly cautious of the fact that the Muslim religion is very respectful of women, that we have not effectively engaged the women who, as in any society, make an awful lot of the decisions and, of course, have huge influence. And we've done a bad job of recruiting Muslim women into the armed forces, into the State Department, to work as interpreters and cultural advisors. And we've also not done as good a job as we should have of outreach to the Afghan women to convince them, explain to them what it is we're trying to accomplish and the better future we're trying to build for them and their children. And so I very strongly take Al-Sayed's point and thank him for it.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Let me see what Assam from Washington has to say. Assam, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi,
with all respect to your guest, I served in Iraq for 2 years, and I know hands-on, you know, the lack of the knowledge in the culture, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan. I think it's a similar situation, and I think that is the what your guest was saying, that we don't see the country through the eyes of the citizens. It's one of the most important points that keeps us, whether it's in Afghanistan or Iraq, for more than a decade.
I think it's a very good point, Issam. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. John, you want to underscore that?
I absolutely do. So, and I'd really like to thank Assam for volunteering to serve America, his adopted country, as a cultural advisor and interpreter. When I was fighting in Al Anbar province of Iraq, the best weapon I had was an Arab American named Frank Nasrawi. We called him Abu Edward. He was the father of Edward, and he absolutely understood the tribal networks, the power relationships, how people interacted. And if I could have had, I would have traded a tank platoon for three more Frank Nasrawis. This is one of the ways I think we really failed as a people. We have a very vibrant Arab-American population, Afghan-American population who speak these languages, who understand the cultures, and we haven't incorporated them into our diplomacy and our military to the extent that we should have. And more of them, more Assams and more Abu Edwards, would be a wonderful contribution to what is going to continue to be a long-term effort to build peace and security throughout the Islamic world.
Assam, thank you for calling into Radio Times. But just picking up on what you said, John Nagel, I mean, what is the resistance to, if not understanding the culture, being sensitive to some of these cultural issues?
The American military, unfortunately, fortunately and unfortunately, has a culture of its own. It attracts a certain kind of person to join, and it tends to replicate itself. And its own culture is so strong and is focused on destroying conventional enemy forces in the field that it overwhelms and overpowers, I think, attempts to bring in other cultures and other perspectives. And this is a long-term problem and challenge. It's something that Secretary Gates recognized, the Secretary of Defense of the United States, an incredibly successful and capable SecDef, has tried hard to move the needle. But the organization, its culture, and a whole lot of laws and regulations stand in the way. Mm. This is something that I think we need to continue to make progress on.
Well, that's interesting that we need to rethink the training of Afghan troops and perhaps the training of American troops as well.
That's exactly right. So my last job on active duty in the American military, I led a battalion that trained advisors of teams of Americans who we would bed inside Afghan and Iraqi forces. And we did the best we could to teach them languages and culture and empathy with the people they were going to work with. We brought Afghan troops over from Afghanistan so they could interact with them in training situations here on the ground. That's a noble effort, but it's an insufficient effort. We're getting better. Stan McChrystal, when he was director of the Joint Staff in the Pentagon, created a program called AFPAC Hands, designed to create specialists in Afghanistan and Pakistan who did long-term language and cultural immersion studies at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. That's another step in the right direction, but this is all coming very late in the war, and these are skill sets that take a long time to develop. We were caught flat-footed, frankly, on September 11th, and we haven't adapted as rapidly as we probably should have to the challenges that we face.
Let me see what Dan from Westchester has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering how the funding for Taliban and Al-Qaeda comes to the drug trade. Why no one's tried to cut it off at the drugs? And also, I remember hearing a story early in the conflict where American soldiers had to stand and let someone come in, dig up the drugs slated for distribution in the United States, and let him take it because they weren't allowed to interfere with their livelihood.
Mm. Well, Dan,
I'll take the answer off the air.
Fair enough. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. John Nagel, how much are drugs fueling this conflict?
Dan is exactly right that opium and heroin provide a very large amount of the funding for the conflict. And also, of course, a drug culture erodes legal authority inside any country. So it's a real problem. The challenge we face is that when we eradicate opium, we push the farmers and the people who they depend on for sustenance into the arms of the Taliban if we don't provide them with an alternative. I'm a Nebraska boy. I understand winter wheat. Winter wheat grows very well in Afghanistan. The problem is you've got to have roads to get it out to market, and we have not done a good job of building the roads and the infrastructure. So I was in Afghanistan in November. I was in a helicopter with an American brigadier general who pointed out, was very proud of a road-building project he had going in his district, and he told me, where the road ends, the Taliban begins. Mm. Because government cannot exert its authority that far down, and the people continue to grow opium and pay a tax of their opium to the Taliban because they don't have any economic alternative. And we have not done as good a job as we should have of understanding the problem holistically and recognizing that destroying the opium by itself is insufficient. We also have to build another way for the Afghan people to pursue a better life for themselves.
We're almost out of time here, but you quote T.E. Lawrence in that piece you had in the New York Times. He said, "Do not try to do too much with your own hands. It's their war, and you are there to help them, not to win it for them."
And that's exactly the strategy we're trying to pursue. It's taken us a long time to understand that strategy. Our efforts to build Afghan security forces, frankly, languished for a number of years while our attention was focused on the Iraq War. I'll close, if I can, with one other T.E. Lawrence quote. Lawrence of Arabia also said, "War on rebellion is messy and slow, like eating soup with a knife." And we've really learned how hard, how long, how slow these wars are over the past decade of war, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, with extraordinary efforts by American troops and American diplomats. And I want to close by paying tribute to them for the sacrifices they and their families have made.
Indeed. And John Nagel, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
A pleasure, Marty.
And he wrote a book called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. He is a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, currently a professor at the U.S. Naval Academy. We began with Graham Boley, a correspondent for the New York Times, who joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.